You're listening to the Full Picture Podcast, a podcast highlighting diversity in the hundreds of roles featured in the end credits you almost never stay for. I'm John Green.
And I'm Darby Barton.
We sat down with Daytime Emmy-nominated art director Leah Burton, whose preferred gender pronouns are she, her. Leah has such a refreshing perspective on the film industry.
She shared about balancing safety with design, how her rare physical difference has influenced her career path, and about how she gains trust and respect from set builders as a woman who at first glance may not appear construction savvy.
We hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did. Leah, it is a pleasure to have you on the Full Picture Podcast. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You are actually the first set designer and art director that we've had on the podcast, which is also very exciting. Tell me a little bit just about you, what your job looks like on a day-to-day basis, and a little bit about how did you get into set design and art direction?
Yeah, well, so I went to film school. I went to USC, and like everyone there, I like wanted to be a director. I wanted to be, you know, like a Spielberg type. And then, of course, you learn really quickly that that's not like an easy career path. It's really open to everyone. So I kind of fell into design because that was a job I didn't really know existed. When I was a kid. And so once I started like working on student films and stuff, I found out I really loved like just the set design aspect of it. So I just like, I did a lot of that in school, and then I was able to graduate with a portfolio, and I just like kept doing that. And I really love the job because it's like such a nice blend for me of like being creative but also technical, because you're kind of like engineering the sets. Like, so on the show I'm on right now, I'm the set designer, so that basically means that I'm like drafting all of the sets or anything that construction needs to build. I have to draw it for them, so that they know how to like make this sort of, you know, the vision that's in the production designer's mind, like make it a physical reality. So it's kind of cool to just be able to like be creative and add my taste to it, but also like get to work a lot with numbers and, you know, some of the more black and white aspects that are less creative. It's kind of a perfect marriage of those aspects to me.
Yeah. Did you find it difficult to start getting work in the industry, or were you able, since you had that portfolio working on short films, were you able to kind of start getting right to work?
No, it was pretty hard. I graduated in 2010, so it was like the recession, and like there were literally more movies filmed in New Orleans that year than in LA. So it was definitely rough. So like I would say for the first 2 years, I was working mostly on like micro budget indie stuff, so like really small commercials, like indie movies, like the kind of thing where you like you make like $50 a day, that kind of work.
Yeah.
So it was definitely like a hustle. And then I was like I was a script reader on the side to make money. So yeah, it definitely took a while just to get even like my first art PA job on a studio film. I think that was like maybe 2 years after graduating.
What was that experience like, getting that first studio job, even as a PA? Like, what was that like for you?
It was very exciting. It was one of the Paranormal Activity movies.
Oh, cool.
They made me watch all the previous ones for like research, and I had nightmares for a week. It was terrible. I totaled my car on that movie too. So it was just like this added, like, you know, paranormal horribleness. But it was fun. And I think the most important thing career wise was just that I met people that worked in the studio world. And so like once you get that first job, it's definitely easier to like keep getting jobs, because at least you know people and you've kind of been tested, like they've seen you work. So Yeah, so that was exciting.
Cool. What's your favorite part of being a set designer or an art director? Like, what's, because I know there's a lot of different things you can do in an art department. So what's your favorite thing to specialize in?
Well, I really, really love drafting. So that's why I kind of go back and forth between art directing and set design, because set design, drafting is like 90% of the job.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I mean, it's a pretty nerdy thing because it's all just like, you know, AutoCAD and like sitting in front of a computer with the calculator.
Mm-hmm.
But I really, really enjoy that aspect of it. But then the other aspect that I love is just like working with people, because you're interfacing with construction and with set deck and with, you know, all these different departments. So it can be a very social job.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now in the time of COVID, it's much more isolating.
How have you adapted your workflow because of COVID? I'm guessing that's changed a lot of things.
Oh, for sure. So, well, the most obvious thing is like right now I'm entirely remote.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is just like me in my apartment on the computer, lots of Zoom meetings, lots mm-hmm. of Slack. But I definitely miss like getting to just go to stage every day and just see like what's physically happening.
Yeah.
So that part's kind of sad. I'll get like photos.
Well, at least you have the photos for your memory. But yeah, that's nothing like being on set and actually seeing your work finished right there.
Yeah, and we're in such a social industry, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, I feel like I really took for granted just all the time spent, like, catching up with people, mm-hmm. or you kind of be brainstorming ideas for a set, but just, like, casually.
Yeah.
And now nothing is casual. Everything is, like, a Zoom meeting, or like everything's like a presentation. You don't really get that organic, oh yeah, we were just like hanging out at lunch and we saw this thing and then it inspired us. So I definitely miss that.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you think it takes for someone to succeed working in the art department or being a set designer or being an art director? What are like some of the key things that you've learned that have helped you be successful?
You definitely have to be willing to work really hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a job I would recommend to anyone that doesn't love it. Just, I mean, sheer number of hours you got to put in is like, you got to be pretty committed, because it's like mm-hmm. 10 to 12 hours minimum. And I think also just like be willing to work with a lot of different people. We have a lot of different personality types.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a lot of stereotypes about like personalities in art department, but you also got to be willing to work with like construction personalities, set deck personalities, even mm-hmm. like grips and electrics. You're going to have to work with them. So I would say it's probably like a better job if you're kind of like a people person and you enjoy dealing with a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't like it, then it'll be a very disappointing job to do.
Yeah.
And I guess just advice-wise, like for anyone that is interested in being in art department, I would say like definitely try to keep up with technology because the expectations, like as technology improves and like what we're able to do improves, the expectations also get higher and higher.
Yeah.
So it's good if you know how to draft. It's good if you know how to 3D model. It's good if you know how to render
mm-hmm.
and, you know, even just be like really good at Photoshop and all that stuff. We're increasingly digital. So I think, you know, when I was in school and even when I was a PA, I would do like, you know, 3D models, like real life
mm-hmm.
foam models, which we still do sometimes. But more and more, it's like all digital.
Yeah. That's a lot. I did not realize how many programs and things like that set designers have to know now. That's crazy.
Well, it's interesting because like we still have hand drafters
mm-hmm.
who like, you know, don't even want to check their email. So you have the full spectrum of like technology still going. But I would say like the people that work the most are the ones who like try to keep up. And I really love hand drafters. Like I learned so much from them because their drawings are just like beautiful. Like they're works of art. But definitely they have more trouble finding work now because like speed is everything. Mm-hmm. And now that everyone's remote, like being able to just send screenshots or share what you're drawing, like literally sharing your screen, that's all become kind of a job requirement.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like I would imagine that directors kind of want to be able to visualize an entire space. And so being able to build a 3D model of a set and being able to like kind of just walk through it and see it in 360 is it's very important, especially if you're working in visual effects or any that kind of stuff where you're building just places that don't exist at all in the real world and you're designing them in 3D. That's crazy. So what do you... kind of piggybacking off the success thing, what do you think it takes to succeed as a woman in the industry? And how has that experience been for you?
I mean, I think you just have to be really confident or good at faking confidence. Because I'm very small. I'm 4'8". So whenever I work with new like construction guys, there's always like a 2-week period where they don't really trust me. Like I can kind of see it in their eyes, like they're like, because I don't look like a person that would understand construction. So I spend like the first 2 weeks like trying with all my heart to not make any mistakes and like assure them that I understand their language and like I know what they need. And so usually after that 2-week period, then they like me. I mean, not that they don't like me before, but there's just a sense, there's a questioning of my competence. And I've learned that I just have to be very confident in my own abilities, like just know that I'm good at this job. They just need to know that I'm good at it. So I just have to win them over. So one time I was on this movie, and the art director started maybe, or no, I was the art director on that one. The production designer started like a week before me. And when I started, he was like, oh, don't worry. I already told them like, you're really small, but you're really smart. I like didn't know how to take that because it's like, I guess it's a compliment. You think I'm smart, but I don't know why my size.
Well, yeah, why does your size have, like it, it's like they're kind of complimenting you, but it also kind of sounds condescending as well. It's really, I don't know, it's a weird, weird way.
It's like, I guess that's just like how people think about those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think confidence is key for a lot of people and how people perceive you. I know for me personally, you know, I've struggled with confidence a lot my entire life. I have a physical condition where my skin is very dry and, you know, it sheds a lot. And so I've just, my entire life, I've kind of walked with that. I'm like, are people thinking about this or that? And, you know, that's kind of, it, confidence does go a long way in that. And I know Darby mentioned as well that you also have a physical difference. And how has that played a role for you and how have you been able to kind of overcome that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all kind of rolls together in like one ball of people having like weird unconscious bias.
Yeah.
Because I'm very small, my face is kind of different, my voice is not very authoritative, and I'm also half deaf. Like there's just all these things about me that are like maybe less than physically ideal. I guess I would say that like having grown up being different and like having, you know, been bullied in school and like gone through all of that stuff, I think I just had to learn very early on that my self-worth couldn't be based on like what other people thought. So I think that's probably been helpful, just that I kind of go into meetings and interviews just like, well, this is me. Like,
yeah,
you want to work with me or not?
I definitely understand that. I mean, after a while, you kind of get used to what people will say, or you already kind of know what they're thinking anyway. And you're just like, whatever, I don't really care what you think. Like, this is what I do. This is what I'm good at. And that's all that really matters.
Yeah, and it's a weird industry. I don't know if you feel this too, but like, I feel like Hollywood always wants to project how like progressive we are, and we accept everyone, we love everyone, we're so great. But then when you like actually go to a set or like look at who's in charge, like, it's not the most open place, and it's very superficial, even behind the scenes. I think we just have this very weird value system where it's like we want to look like we value everyone, but then also we secretly don't.
So did you grow up in LA as well?
No, I grew up in Oregon.
In Oregon? Okay.
Yeah.
So you moved down here to go to USC, I assume, yeah?
Yeah, so I've been in LA my whole adult life. So I definitely feel like an Angelina, but I think it was good to not grow up in LA, especially just with all of like my medical issues and stuff. So I was in a small town and like everyone kind of knew me. I grew up with a lot of the same people all the way through high school. So I could kind of have some self-worth that would be torn down once I got to USC. I started with a more solid base, I think.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to ask you, when we were talking about, your condition, I don't actually know what it is called or what it is. Could you just tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, it's called Pfeiffer syndrome. It's very rare. It's like 1 in 100,000. So it's very complicated. It's basically like all your skull bones fuse early in utero. And so it just creates a lot of problems, like with just anything to do with your head, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the first thing that happened when I was like really young was like they opened up my skull so my brain could expand. So like mentally, I'm very normal. But if that hadn't happened, like I would probably be a very different person. And I think also because it's so rare, like everybody's experience is like very unique.
Yeah.
So I know quite a few people like across the country, like with different ages that have it. And it's like, we're all just very unique, even in our uniqueness.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting. So how has that impacted, you know, the choices you've made in your career or the direction that you've chosen to go in at all?
I don't know. I mean, I think I watched a lot of movies. Like anytime I had surgery, it was sort of this tradition. We would go to Blockbuster back when that was a thing. And we'd get like, you know, they used to have those bins. I don't know how old you are. They used to have those bins where it's like five for $25.
Yep.
Yeah. So we'd do that before every surgery and just get like a ton of movies. And most of them are bad because they're like the rejects that wouldn't sell. But I just, you know, early on, I really loved movies. So that was kind of what made me want to be in the entertainment industry. I don't think there's really a connection between my condition and like being a set designer and art director specifically. But I really like the escapism that movies provided and TV provided, so I just really wanted to be a part of that.
I definitely understand that. That was kind of the thing for me, is movies were always an escape. You know, it's where I got to go to be away from everyone else and kind of live in my own world. And that's what drew me into the production world as well. What movies then have influenced you? Are there particular films that you think about that have influenced your career? But now that you've gone down the path of art direction and set design, are there movies that you kind of look at and as inspiration for your work?
When I was a kid, I went through a years-long obsession with all of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that heightened reality, you know what I mean? Where everything is just a little extra.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that. So I think that's kind of like my dream would be to like design something like that.
Okay.
When we're working on a show, a lot of the design is obviously dictated by the script. So you can't get like a gritty drama script and then be like, we're going to make it like Singing in the Rain. Like that would be very inappropriate. But I think just in general, like I do like incorporating like a lot of classic architecture and stuff like that, that was very big in those musicals, and like really cool saturated colors and,
mm-hmm.
That's always fun, like when you can kind of sneak stuff like that in.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you have any favorite directors that you like, that, you know, you love the art direction that they go with in their movies?
Yeah. Wait, what's that guy's name? It's terrible. Moulin Rouge guy.
Oh, Moulin Rouge. I forgot who directed that.
But he's really cool. And his...
Oh, yeah, that was Baz Luhrmann, right?
Oh, yes. Okay. So his stuff is really cool. I mean, his movies don't always do super well, but they always look amazing.
Yeah.
And his wife is his production designer and costume designer.
Oh, so cool. I didn't realize
Yeah, so I think they're a very like united front. Like I think they both have like the same taste, and mm-hmm. so everything they do together, it's just like very it's just so polished.
Yeah.
Yeah, so really
Their sets are beautiful. The set design and art direction is gorgeous. It's very, very well done.
And sometimes that's all you need. You just want to look at pretty pictures.
Yeah, that's true. So do you have like a dream job or a dream project that you would want to work on?
Not specifically, but I think it would just be cool to like be on something where you just have like an unlimited budget.
Mm.
Yeah. And just like go crazy.
That would be cool. I think that's everyone's dream, no matter which department you work in. It's just like, just give me all the money so I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, or like a Marvel movie or something where like mm-hmm. everything is kind of heightened and that's always really cool.
If you haven't gathered by now, Lee is pretty comfortable in her own skin.
Before recording the podcast, we read her bio, which mentions, quote, her start in the indie world, including dozens of micro-budget projects that you've likely never heard of, including a Lifetime movie about a homicidal nun, which IMDb reviewers referred to as salacious cheese and surprisingly bad. Her projects have come a long way since then, but we love the authenticity and humor that these experiences have added to Leah's perspective.
We also wanted to quickly share how you can support what Full Picture Podcast is doing to highlight diversity in the film industry. We know you hear this all the time, but it really is true that leaving a review helps other people find our podcast.
So if you enjoy the show, please leave us a quick review and share the podcast with one person you know.
You can also support us by contributing to our Patreon so we can keep creating impactful content. Now, back to the show. What has been your favorite experience so far? Like, whether it's on set or a project you got to work on, what's been your favorite experience in your career so far?
I have so many for like different reasons. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times my favorite experiences really just have to do with like the people who are mm-hmm. involved. Like if I like the people, even if the show or movie doesn't turn out very good, you know, it's a fun memory for me.
Yeah.
So last year, I worked on Euphoria
mm-hmm.
for HBO, and that was like really fun because it was just, that's one of those shows where it is very heightened reality and like everything was super stylized. It was a very stressful show to work on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like very like creatively fulfilling, and I really liked all the people in our department. And I don't know if you saw the show, but there was like, we had this huge high school bathroom, and I must have drawn like 50 versions of that set.
Wow.
And so that's like one of the sets I'm most proud of, just because of all of the work and time that went into it. Yeah. I'm sure when people watch the show, it just looks like a high school bathroom. But it was like, it was a big accomplishment mm-hmm. to me. It's not even the coolest set I've done, but it's just like so much went into it. So I was very proud. It ended up being like this big octagon shape. And like they did a lot of really cool shots in it. There's like overhead tracking shots and yeah. like, and it's like, you know, in your heart that this yeah. is a work of art.
So, you know, you've mentioned kind of you get to work with a lot of different people. So when you're working as an art director, who are like kind of the key people that you partner with?
So when you're art directing, you are the number two in the art department. So the mm-hmm. production designer is your direct boss, and they're the ones that determine like the entire look of any given show. Mm-hmm. So you work very closely with them, and your job is basically to make their, you know, whatever's in their head, make it become a reality.
Yeah.
So then you also have to deal that you have a lot of people that are kind of under you, like in the umbrella of the art department. So that would be like construction. Mm-hmm. You work very closely with set deck. So set deck, they do all of like just all of the stuff.
Yeah.
So furniture, trinkets, art on the walls, all that. Yeah. You also yeah. work with props. So that's like anything that the actors touch basically becomes mm-hmm. a prop. And then you also have to like be the liaison between art department and other departments that fall outside of the art department umbrella. So that would be grips and electrics. Definitely like you work very closely with the director of photography to make mm-hmm. sure that all the sets are shootable.
yes. Thank you.
That's very important.
It really is. I've worked in some sets that are very, very difficult to shoot in. So I appreciate your
well,
work.
Well, the worst is when you have a set where the director wants like mirrors everywhere.
Oof, no.
You're like, yes, but we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. Then you need your entire visual effects department to start cutting out everyone out of the reflections and all of that.
Yes. So you also do have to work with VFX, mm-hmm. also with special effects. Mm-hmm. And the difference would be like visual effects, you know, it's all the post-production effects, and special effects are the people that are like building the crazy things that are practical. That mm-hmm.
all of your real on-set explosions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Who else do you work with? I feel like it ends up being everyone at some point. Producers yeah. a lot, just because producers have their hand in everything. Yeah.
That's great. So I feel like I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because I read something about this the other day. But what distinguishes something as a props, something that's under the prop department, versus when it's under set deck?
I mean, there's definitely some overlap, so it's not like a hard cut thing, but the mm-hmm. general rule is like if the actor touches it, it's a mm. prop.
Okay.
There's also a lot of overlap between like props and wardrobe, mm. like with jewelry, or like, you know, maybe they are wearing sunglasses, but then they take them off and do something with them. So there is a lot of overlap, but I guess the common thread would just be like, if the actor's touching it.
Yeah, then it becomes a prop. So how tight then does your communication have to be between those different departments? And who kind of determines who's taking the responsibility for certain things if it can lie in multiple departments?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to make sure you have a lot of meetings where mm-hmm. like everyone's there and can like talk about that. And if you have a good set decorator and a good prop master, they're already like talking to each other. Mm-hmm. It's just sometimes there will be shows where like maybe they hate each other, and then it requires a little more intervention. But generally, like, people understand that there's overlap, so that'll usually be like a priority to figure out as soon as possible, like who's doing what.
So as you kind of were coming up in your career and getting started, did you have people who helped mentor you and teach you along the way? And what's some of the best advice that they've given you?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have like official mentors, but I was that PA who would just ask a lot of questions and like follow people around. There was a several years early in my career where I was kind of going back and forth between being a PA on studio stuff and then like production designing indie stuff. I just kind of switch back and forth. So I'd try to take anything I learned on the studio side and try to implement it in my indie stuff.
Yeah.
Not always possible because you have no money on indie stuff. But it was like a good aspirational thing. I think with like set designers, I would like ask them tons of questions. I think the best help I got from them was like they would let me draw stuff and just show it to them and just get very honest feedback on what I was doing. I think if you don't have a mentor but you're trying to like learn and grow and work your way up in this business, asking a lot of questions is a good way to go. Because the other thing I've realized is people like to feel smart. So if you ask them questions that they know the answers to, they feel so good, like, telling you how to do things. But it's like they just need that permission. Like, you have to ask the question. Like, people don't generally just go around, like, handing out advice. And they definitely won't hand out constructive criticism unless you, like, specifically ask, you know, what can I do better? So that was kind of something that I learned as a PA. And I mean, I think the best specific advice I got set design wise was if you don't know how to draw something, because we're always getting weird stuff that we've never had to draw before. Like suddenly there's a spaceship, like good luck, you know? So if it's something that's kind of unconventional and you don't know what you're doing, just make it clear. Like don't be so concerned about the drawing being really pretty or like following the conventions, because there aren't always conventions. Just make it very clear what you're trying to do. Be very honest with your construction people of like, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. Help me help you make this, you know.
Do you ever use a lot of reference material? Maybe like if you're designing a spaceship, so you like look up spaceships from other shows and stuff and kind of get that as an idea, or are you able to like, you know, pull screenshots from other shows as well and kind of give that to people and say, oh, we're kind of looking for something similar to this, or how does that work?
Oh, no. There's always like a long, well, not always long, it depends on how much time you have, but research is a huge factor, like in any set, even things that you might think are not that exciting. You know, like doctor's office waiting room, it's like you think you know what that is, but it's actually very helpful to like go find 20 photos of different styles. And because it is such a visual medium, like it's very helpful when you're talking to directors or cinematographers of like, hey, this is the look that we're going for. Like, here's 5 different examples that we're kind of trying to combine different elements from. So research is definitely a big part of the process.
I mean, there are a lot of very, very ugly doctor's offices, so,
and sometimes that's what you want, you know, sometimes that's what will serve the script.
Do you have other PAs that you work with, and how has your approach been with them and kind of passing your knowledge onto them and helping them grow in the industry as well?
I guess I just try to treat them the way that like a lot of the best people treated me. Like if I know that they're interested in something, like trying to give them more opportunities for that, and just like be available to answer questions and stuff. And on the rare occasion when I can, you know, try to recommend them for other jobs or like help promote them. Because one of the hardest parts about this industry is like getting into the union. And so, I mean, it took me a while. And I got in because a show that I was art directing flipped. So it is that weird combination of getting lucky, but also being persistent enough to even be able to get lucky. Yeah, it's an awful catch 22. You need 30 days. It's the same for Art Directors Guild. You need 30 days of union work, but you can't be hired on a union show unless you're already union.
So how do you make that jump? You basically have to be on a non-union production that flips?
Yeah, well, so the story of how I got in is I was a PA on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And then I got a call on a Thursday night that this movie shooting out in Tennessee and Virginia desperately needed an art director. And I had been recommended like by two separate people. So even though the crew had never met me, it was like enough to like hire me blindly. So they were like, can you be here Monday? So I was like, sure. So I went into Brooklyn Nine-Nine the next day on Friday, and I was like, hi, it's my last day here. And they were so nice. Like the Brooklyn Nine-Nine people, and they're still working on that show. They're just
I love that show.
It's it's a great show, and it's like the nicest people ever. So they were very supportive. And they knew it was a good opportunity for me. So, I packed over the weekend, jumped on a plane, and art directed this movie in like the middle of nowhere. And that movie ended up flipping. I got my 30 days. So that was how I got grandfathered in. And this was after 6 years of art PAing and like, you know, designing indie movies. So, it was something I'd been waiting for a long time, but then it just happened very quickly.
So is Brooklyn Nine-Nine not union, or was it just because you were a PA that it doesn't count? And so the work you do as a PA doesn't count towards your union hours. That's tough.
There's some rule where if you've been working in art department for some absurd number of days, I don't even know what it is. It's like several years of working constantly, like that kind of number. I think you can put that towards your application, but it's tricky. And they've added a portfolio review process in the time that I've been in the union. So I'm very thankful for that, because at least that's a merit base.
How did it work when they switched? So obviously they hire you. They weren't set up as a union shoot. But once they switch, because you're already on the shoot, it doesn't matter. You're allowed to work on it. So how do they get that switch to happen for them?
Well, it happened unwillingly. So I think they, which is usually how it goes, actually. So this independent production made the mistake of hiring a bunch of like high up union people in the smaller unions that are in the South. And so immediately they organized, and basically the production was like strong-armed into signing the an union IOC contract. And that is usually how it goes. I mean, it's
lucky for you.
I'm very grateful for it. It's just, it's such a weird system.
So that must have felt like a huge risk for you, quitting a show that's consistent work, even if it was as a PA, to go do this film. And where did you say you guys shot it?
It was on the border of Tennessee and Virginia.
Do you think that was one of the biggest risks you've taken in your career?
Oh, for sure. It was very, I think because it happened so fast, I didn't have time to think about how potentially stupid it could be. I just like went with it. But it ended up being really fun. And I think You know, the nature of this business is that every job you take is a risk. You know, even though that's kind of an extreme example, I think coming up in the indie world where I was asked to do ridiculous things all the time kind of just made that like a logical choice. Like, of course I'll just get on a plane and see what happens.
I mean, you're not wrong. It's everything kind of feels like a risk, I think, at most times. Every gig you pick up, because you never know. It could be the worst gig you've ever taken. It could be the best. You have no idea.
I guess what you learn early on too is that even the worst jobs can be learning experiences.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So even if like you don't have the best time, it's something that you experience. It's like part of the collage of your life.
Yeah, that's true. So what's next for you? What do you have coming up for 2021?
Well, so we just, I had my last day on Insecure on Friday, mm-hmm. and then we will come back in the new year.
Cool.
And see what happens. All of this COVID spreading all over LA.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll get to finish the season.
Mm-hmm.
I think schedule-wise, we're supposed to go for a couple months. But our attitude this whole time has kind of been, you know, just to go with the flow, just because everything is so unpredictable right now.
You said in your email that you were also nominated for a Daytime Emmy. That's got to feel very exciting. Like, what was it like when you found out you got nominated for an Emmy?
It was, like, very shocking because it was for a show that no one watched and it was canceled almost immediately.
Oh, that's crazy.
But, I mean, it was really exciting and I'm, like, very proud of the work we did on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's this little show called Prince of Peoria.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Netflix. And it's just like this, it was a live audience multicam show.
Really? That's cool. You don't get a lot of those these days.
No, and that was my first time working on one of those. And mm-hmm. it was pretty cool just because it was a kid's show, our tapings were on Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a school night and our office shared a wall with the stage, like the mm-hmm. side where the kids were sitting. So Friday nights, you just hear like screaming for like hours because they're just so excited to be there.
Yeah.
So it was a cool job just because you kind of got the immediate satisfaction of like, oh, people are watching and enjoying this.
Yeah.
When it came out on Netflix, it was not, I guess, watched enough times for the algorithm.
Yeah.
But the producers had submitted us for the Daytime Emmys, I think in all the eligible categories, and then we got nominated for art direction.
That's awesome.
Me and Josie Lamonier was the production designer and Kelly Berry the set decorator. So then the three of us got to go to the little ceremony.
That's so cool. That's very exciting. Well, I've had a wonderful time just hearing your story and getting to know you. It's been a pleasure. Where can our listeners find you on? Are you on Instagram? Where on the social media world do you live?
Yeah, I'm not good at social media, but I'm on Instagram at Burton Leah. Oh, and I also have Twitter, and that one is at Leah Burton.
At Leah Burton. All right, cool. Well, thank you again so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. And hopefully we'll get to have you on the show again someday and catch up with you and see where you're at from there.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. This was super fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. It's been great. Thanks for listening to the Full Picture Podcast. We're so glad to have you journey with us as we hear from diverse industry professionals and paint a full picture of the film industry. You can find us on social media at Full Picture Podcast, and you can follow Leah Burton at Burton Leah. Don't forget to leave us a review, contribute to our Patreon for special bonuses, and share the podcast with one person. Tune in next week for more close-ups on diverse industry pros.